it's the word of the year in Japan with a literal take on the song by Rihanna.
I will also abandon the idea of a work-life balance. I will work, 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 and work.
That was Japan's first female prime minister, Takaishi Sanae, when she was elected head of the Liberal Democratic Party back in October. The 64-year-old Takaishi may espouse work, 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 work. But how about those entering the labor market? 34-year-old Zoran Mamdani was elected mayor of New York. He was powered by young people who, in this age of the gig economy, ask, what's the point of slaving away at a low-paying, high-pressure services sector job when AI is coming for your livelihood, and saving up for a home or a pension seems like a pipe dream. The future's now, they say. One survey has 43% of Gen Zers stating they quit a job because it did not fit their personal lives, compared with 28% of baby boomers. So, what does make a good work-life balance? Is it normal for humans to no longer define themselves by the way they earn their keep? In this age of rapid change and growing inequality, what to expect when it comes to our livelihoods and to our lives? Today in the France 24 debate, how to manage that work-life balance in the digital age. With us, software engineer Dipti Chander. You're president of the nonprofit Emma Foundation, which advocates for diversity in the tech sector. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome as well to Antonio Cazilli, professor of sociology at the Paris Polytechnical Institute, the author of Waiting for the Robots, the Hired Hands of Automation.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show. Welcome as well to Benjamin Chaminade, CEO of Reboot Inc. You are a management consultant, motivational speaker. Your company helps companies develop their
leadership school.
Their leadership skills in-house, if you
Certainly.
Will.
And
with us as well is economist Gilles Saint-Paul, professor at the École Normale Supérieure, also at the Paris School of Economics. You study the evolution of labor markets in this, the digital age. Your books include The Tyranny of Utility. Thanks for joining us. Throughout the year, you can listen. That's right, listen to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Now, through the ages, humans have sung the praises of good old-fashioned hard work. O toil, O noble toil, all benefits come from thee, wrote Austrian composer Franz Josef Haydn at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution in 1801. It's really only when France experienced full employment that youth first pushed back against the notion of punching the clock. Slogans from the May 68 student demonstrations included denouncing, in French, métro boulot dodo, a life solely defined by commuting, work, and sleep. Fast forward to 2025, and another moment of near full employment. For the first time, the annual global survey by recruitment agency Radstad finds a majority of respondents prefer a better work-life balance to more pay. Benjamin Chaminade, is that true? Is there a generation gap or not?
No, I don't think so. It's more like a societal change. And the number you gave, is very surprising, because for me, I don't think we are into this work-life balance thing anymore. Especially if you consider that you have two buckets with a concrete wall between both of this part of your life. I think we are much more into a life, first, life, work, inclusion. When you adapt your work to the life you want to have, especially with remote work.
But you just said it there. Adapt your life to the work you have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So work comes first.
Yeah, no. Uh-huh. Life come first. I am going to choose if I can, because everybody can't choose the work they want, but I will choose the condition of work that adapt to the life I want to have.
Dipti Chander?
Yeah, I just want to say something. I have been close to Gen Zs, how you call them just a couple of seconds ago. I feel like I have seen a shift after COVID where young people prefer to concentrate rather on their personal life rather than doing like hours and hours of work. And they feel this since, you know, when we were in COVID, where we had to stay at home and we had a different way of living due to the constraint of COVID. And I feel like this has still been ongoing until 2025 now. I don't know, next year and the coming years, but the shift I personally have seen. And
give us a concrete example.
Yeah, but well, when I talk with young people and I tell them, I have been working since 20 years or 15 years, and you tell me, oh, okay, we cannot work that much. We want to work a few years just only and stay at home or do some personal work or do some stuff that make us feel fun or enjoy ourselves rather than going to work every day and doing hours and hours of work. So we saw this shift after the COVID. I have seen that personally with people who are younger than me. I'm not that much older, as you can see. But so from my point of view, yes, there is a shift that has been arrived. I think we are seeing the way of living in a different way. I think you have mentioned that. It's a different way of living, which we initially we not used to be like that.
Is it among your students, Antonio Casilli, is it a positive outlook? I want to be a Renaissance person. I want to have fulfillment in all in all the aspects of my life, this perfect work-life balance. Or is it a sort of some even talk about a feeling of nihilism, that there's no point in trying to save up. There's no point in trying to get ahead.
That's a good question. I mean, to be frank, I mean, I do not consider my students to be representative because I teach it in engineering grande école. So it's kind of a strange place with people who feel that they are the kind of Renaissance geniuses that you were mentioning. Nevertheless, I do not think that this is generational. I think that it is contingent and limited to the time that we are living. Of course, you mentioned COVID and the way it changed our attitudes towards labor. But something else happened, all more or less at the same time, which was the rise of generative AI and the fact that nowadays the perception of labor is dovetailing with the way we have been speaking about automation and artificial intelligence for a number of years. Because for a number of years, it has been announced that AI is coming for our job. So it is probably understandable that younger generations, just as like the older ones, consider the job as being a lost cause or something that they should not devote enough time or effort as before. Nevertheless, again, this is probably more of a, let's say, ideological myth than reality, because as we have seen, the numbers and the facts of employment do not go in the direction of saying that jobs are actually destroyed by AI.
Gilles Saint-Paul, do you agree?
Partly. I mean, we don't see that yet, but AI is still starting. We don't know where it will go. What we do know is that contrary to all previous forms of technical progress, which were very beneficial for wages and did not threaten employment except in specific sectors or in the short run, AI can emulate human behavior.
Each big technological leap destroys a lot of jobs. We saw in the 1930s, people were forced off the farm because of the mechanization of agriculture.
In the 1930s, there was the Great Depression, which was the key cause of unemployment, not technical progress. And of course, people are forced off the farm. Agricultural employment is always falling, but then they work somewhere else, like industry or services. So I've always been, you know, big enthusiast of technical progress, which is the reason why we live so well. Everybody around this table, we have iPhones and we can buy cheap industrial goods that are mass-produced with advanced technologies thanks to innovation. But the novelty with AI, which worries me, is that AI is conceived to emulate the human brain. So you give me one task made by human, in principle, you know, over some horizon, maybe not now, maybe in 5 years, AI can do it. AI is a way of producing as many humans as you need. Okay? I could even, you know, predict that the future society, maybe in 20 years, will look like ancient Rome with plenty of slaves that will be, in fact, robots and AI. And if you are part of the plebs, if you are not a patrician, then you compete with those slaves, and it will be hard for you to live out of your out of your labor.
So, in other words, there's going to be, Dipti, listening to Gilles Saint-Paul,
yeah,
there's going to be the masters of the universe, software engineers, the ones who program the machines,
yeah,
and then there's going to be all the others in the gig economy who are competing with machines?
So just
AI is very good at programming. Mm.
So, just one thing. When internet arrived, we were all saying it will destroy all the works. Internet will take over the work, and people will have less jobs, etc. I just want to put a highlight on a key figure. The Economic Times at that time sorted out was one job destroyed, internet created 2.4. Mm-hmm. So we always afraid of what's coming next because we don't know and we think it will destroy, but it will, of course, create a different way of thinking, different way of producing, different way of working every day, in which we need to take all this shift. So you were mentioning about AI is very powerful. It is powerful for sure, but it is powerful unless we want to leave it being as much powerful as human want to be, that AI should be powerful. So it's in our hands to make sure we control them. How much we can control them, it's also in our hands.
But if you're an employer and you have to choose, and we live in a country with high payroll taxes and strict labor law, if you have to choose between hiring someone or using a robot, you're going to pick a robot.
So
right?
in this case, I just want to say something very important is that AI, we won't stop AI. We will not stop AI in the coming years. We will not. So the company's responsibility also is to make sure that we put in place education staffs, we train people, we help them go and leverage this shift. This is super important what I'm saying. It is not taken enough into consideration.
How do you leverage it?
And by training people. It's very important. Training people. Training costs 2 hours, for example, per week. You can take the people of your companies who you think would be impacted by AI and shift them another way, another position. It is very important.
What kind of skills would you give them? And we hear a lot about creativity and soft skills, and I think this is really a lie. If anything, AI is very good at creativity and at, you know, pretending to have soft skills. ChatGPT is very good at flattering you and going in your direction much more than I am, actually. I cannot think of, you know, a sphere where humans could shelter themselves from the competition of AI. Yeah.
So, Benjamin Chaminin.
That's why, before this show, you asked me a question about what would ChatGPT would told me about you. And my answer was that I've wrote articles, like the title of the article is Benjamin Chaminin according to ChatGPT. And I wrote the article with what I wanted it to know about me. And when you look at ChatGPT on my name, maybe 80% of this comes from the thing I wrote.
So you trained your own ChatGPT
exactly.
page?
Absolutely.
Exactly. Okay.
Just to try to...
And to answer the question posed here, what do you advise? You're advising companies and managers,
absolutely,
right? What do you advise when it comes to training for the new normal? What kind of jobs can these people do, the ones that are replaceable?
That's a very good point, because now we are not talking about white collar or blue collar, but is your job AI insulated or AI exposed? That's a real question. And this is the thing that, I don't know. Actually, the thing is we are all being held hostage by six people and their investors who are fighting each other in an ideological war.
Who are these six people?
Altman and all of these.
Oh, so Jensen Huang.
There are six main people. I don't talk about the engineer side, the one who really do the work. I'm talking about the one who are selling AI and are pushing us into the narrative that AI is going to save us or destroy your job. You have to pick a side.
Antonio Casali.
Kazili.
Kazili, excuse
well, anyways,
me.
I think that, we have a good start for this debate. I'm confident that we can agree that around work there is a number of concerns, a number of fears that converge on labour in general, which could explain why people feel disaffected. They feel that their identity, their subjectivity is not defined by work, because work is the place, the site where all the fears and all the risks associated with our societies concentrate. So what do? Of course, they tend to invest emotionally, personally, more on the leisure side. Now, the problem is that even if we look at the leisure side of our lives, leisure has been colonized by work. Think about what we do for leisure. Of course, there are a number of outside activities and physical activities, but a lot of our leisure now is done via the same tools that we use for work. On our computers, on our equipment, and so, this means basically that there is one way of work to progressively, insert itself in our own activity. And if you think about the way we consume, online media, we are also invited to perform a little extra work to make them work better. For instance, we need to like and subscribe on YouTube. This is, it, to an extent.
To the debate. It's a great idea.
Yeah, but this is also part of my leisure. I need to add content to ChatGPT or to any social media to make it work better. In order for ChatGPT to give accurate information about you, you had to provide some extra work for it. Was it for leisure? Was it for fun? Was it for work? This is the big problem. And this big question mark, the blurring of lines between work and leisure constitute today's uncertainty.
It has a name, it's called the third state.
Mm-hmm.
You are not resting, you are.
It's a brilliant idea.
These things, we're always on, right? We're always on. You don't know
not
whether it's
me. I'm out of battery half of the time.
But you're always, when you have your phone with you, you're either being invited to a party or being told of some important job to do at work.
Carrying with you a thermometer, a video cassette recorder, a photo camera, a typewriter,
telephone.
Exactly.
You forgot the main one.
And a phone, yeah, exactly. Right. I forgot the main one, absolutely. So, of course, we all have it because it's an invention that is incredibly powerful. And in fact, I wrote a blog post on my blog saying, GDP is huge. That is to say, if you, for example, you measure the number of photographs that people send to each other and take and develop thanks to this little object, and you price all this activity at the cost of doing so in the 1970s, this is called, real...
This is the heart of the matter, isn't it?
Real GDP. Terms of this, this is huge. We are almost satiated with photographs.
This is the heart of the matter. We've become, sort of unwittingly, so much more efficient than we were before, Dipti Chander. We're
in some activities.
But we're always on. We're always on for both leisure, a lot of these leisure activities, right, which are gamified,
whether it's work. As leisure, it's just a tool. I mean, it's like if you were... your point is excellent, but there is a little bit of sophistry in the sense,
No,
you could say if I go to Oktoberfest in Munich, I'm in a building. And actually, in this building, the waiters and waitresses, they work, right? And if I go to a factory, I'm also in a building. That does not disqualify
Oktoberfest. Your metaphor, it's me pouring my own beer the Oktoberfest. That would be. But anyway,
While Gilles Saint-Paul is at Oktoberfest drinking a beer, he might get a call if his phone is charged about work, and he might answer that call, or he might answer some email. So even though, people are saying, I don't want to work as long hours, getting back to our point from earlier, were actually kind of always on, even on the weekend.
Right. So, but there were peasant ancestors who are always on. Yeah.
Yeah, but to be honest, there is an option that is called out of office. When you are out of office, to be honest, let's use it. And I think maybe Gen Z will teach us more to use it because we're very focusing on a work-life balance, which we forgot. And just to getting back on what has been said. The control of technology, again, it's in our hand. I know me and Francois, you were mentioning, we're always connected. And one thing is very important also is that the golden years of those Gen Zs has been spent over the COVID period. So they know how to live the life and how to also work when they want to work. So the work-life balance they have discovered then rather than what we used to know historically.
So predating COVID here in France, the government passing a bill in 2017, the right to disconnect law. It means that even though it's all hands on deck in our newsroom upstairs between 5 and 6 p.m., our email system sends us this general reminder that it's outside of working hours and to only hit send if it's absolutely necessary. That right to disconnect, people kind of laugh at it a bit in other parts of the world. Benjamin Chaminade, your thoughts about that?
No, because it's been copied. It's been copied in the UK, in Australia. It's spreading. Even if in France...
And does it work? Is it happening?
I don't know if it worked because we don't speak about it anymore. You have no information about it. It's a law in France, but nobody's talking about it like it's done.
Yeah, but it's also it has to be implemented in each company separately according to agreement with the workforce, and which makes it very fragmented, so difficult to track. But it is true that several other countries have followed the example of France, and that it has, to an extent, established that there should be, again, it's a norm, it's a law, there should be a difference between the moment where you work and the moment where you don't. But the reason why they had to come up with this law is also because this blurring of lines between life and work was already in place at the time.
And this an employee can say no. I mean, legally, as you just mentioned, it's a law. Employee can say, I'm not working from 6 to 12, for example.
Yeah, so you won't get fired for it, but will
you
get ahead?
There's no consequences.
But will you get ahead in the company?
The legality is that I get an email from a student at 0 hour, 38 minutes, telling me, look, you need to sign this document by 11 a.m. today.
And this brings us back to the moment where we basically discover that this blurring of lines also means that the rhythms of our days and nights are entirely screwed by this new way of communicating. You know, the typical 1980s, so we're going back in time, you know, several centuries ago, when workers said we want 8 hours for work, 8 hours for leisure, 8 hours to sleep. Now it has been completely blurred. You wake up in the morning and probably like many other persons, first thing you do, you check your emails and your messages online, and then you have your first coffee and then do some other work while preparing to go to work. Or, for instance, your days can be entirely exploded.
You heard Dipti say, I'm a fool for doing that.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is, again, that the norm and the reality always tend to go in a certain direction. It's
but there is a little class issue there, because you have the working classes, and they want to disconnect. They don't want their boss to instruct them to do this and that at any time of the day or during the weekend. And then you have the people, you know, the bourgeoisie, say, for whom, who believe rightly or wrongly that their work is very important and they are supposed to get a personal fulfillment out of their work.
Yeah, but say the middle class, not the bourgeoisie in this case.
Yeah, not the bourgeoisie, but the managerial class or the educated class. And these people, the blurring was there before the internet. These graduates from business schools, they were supposed to go on weekends, doing an integration, a motivational weekend with their company. And of course, if you said, no, I want to be with my family, you were being ostracized.
But we heard Antonio there use a term which I think is important, performing. On TikTok, there's a hashtag that's gone viral, 5 to 9. It's where users show their best life between the hours of 5 p.m. and 9 p.m., or in some cases, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. Through the grapevine, she can be a diva, cold like Minnesota, hotter than a fever. Oh, shit, here we go again, I'm falling in. I was on fire. Where did you go? I could die for you. So much to say about that, Antonio. Is it a competition showing off your best life, or is it having a bit of fun?
You know what? First of all, it is production. They are producing content during the 5 to 9 bracket.
Are you more of a 5 to 9 a.m. or a 5 to 9 p.m. kind of? 5 p.m. to 9
p.m. I work early in the morning and I finish late night, so I'm not the reference for work-life balance, to be honest.
Just to qualify this, the whole 5 to 9 thing, there is pushback in some quarters. One TikTok user making light of that old adage that the future belongs to those who rise early. They're 6 a.m., 7:30 a.m., the cat shows up. All right, and then finally she gets up a bit. Benjamin Chaminade, are you up at 5 a.m. at the gym?
No, because the gym opens at 6. So it's real.
But everything is gamified, right? Everything, and again, this blurring of lines.
If you're in Australia, it starts at 5, actually. The sun is set, you know, it's dark around 4:35 in Australia, even in summer. So life starts at 5. And at 5, you can see many TikToks about this. It's a free way of runners around the beach everywhere because life starts at 5. So it's not that impressive. It will be way more impressive, in Paris, in France.
But I think the lines that might be as much the anomaly as the blurring of lines. The lines were established because following the assembly line, the Industrial Revolution, plenty of meaningless work and repetitive work emerged. But that was a little bit of a novelty. If you were a peasant, even though it was a very humble work, it was at the same time very meaningful. And you had to blur the lines because nature does not stop at 5. Maybe we are getting out of an era where wage earners were doing repetitive work, very procedural, specified. And maybe thanks to AI, this is going to disappear. And then the blurring of lines is going to be natural again. I do research in economics. If I have a great idea on Saturday at noon, I'm not going to
wait until
Monday noon. I have a German colleague who does that, actually, but he's German. But I'm not going to wait until Monday noon to write down my idea and see where that goes. And in fact, I might forget about my idea before Monday noon.
Dipti Chander?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think it's up to...
You don't
to...
wait till Monday noon.
No, I don't. I think I don't even wait 5 minutes, you know. I just write down...
So you're always on.
Yeah, I'm always on. I guess it's personal. It's very personal. And it's up to the boundaries we each of us want to put around us. I guess this is very, very important to say. We forgot that boundaries are set by ourselves. And then the 5 a.m. or the 9 is up to us.
All right. There is this question. You mentioned earlier COVID. After COVID, better work-life balance for those whose jobs permitted it was to continue to punch in remotely. Now bosses want their employees back at the office, particularly in Asia. One study put forth by the World Economic Forum shows that employees in China, nearly 5 days at the office now. India, 4.4. South Korea, 4.2. This idea that remote working, the pendulum is swinging the other way. Is that something you're finding, Antonio?
Well, there is a bias there because those countries have been characterized by this kind of strong work ethics since almost 60 years. If you go back, Sanae Takaishi, work is not new to a Japanese worker because they have been, since the 1980s, involved in this kind of work to death ethics. The same thing for Korea, South Korea, the same thing more recently for India. But I think that is probably a mistake to only focus on the number of hours that we spend in an office. We also have to look at the time and the breaks and the rhythms that we have in an office. And these rhythms have been rendered more flexible recently, despite the COVID, despite the back-to-office, back-to-work approach that we have. This means that basically a lot of companies have created not the 9-to-5 situation, but in a situation where workers can somehow modulate their own time. And this is something that impacts also the moment where they decide.
Is that a false sense of freedom? So, yes, yeah. I can organize my life the way I want, but then I also have more responsibility. And in the end, I wind up working more.
This is exactly the point. This kind of flexibility is a productivity trick. It's a ruse to have persons, workers, more involved in their own projects all day long and probably all week long.
Asia is not the only case, even France. Companies are asking employees to come back at least 3 times per week on site and take, for example, Thursday or Friday as work from home. This is something which has been required even in the contract of employees. So I think there was a way in the past where work from home was needed due to the critical situation. Now that it's less, I think coming back on site and having this hybrid way of working is also a good way to continue.
So Benjamin Chaminade, what's your experience? What do managers want and what do employees want?
That's very interesting because we had before COVID two sides of the story. You had employees wanted to have more remote work. The thing is, it wasn't a problem of organization for them. It was a problem of trust from their management. And on the other side, you had freelancers and independent contractors who wanted to work together, working in the famous...
The open space.
Open space. No, not open space.
Co-working space.
Co-working space.
Co-working space.
Thank you. And now that... So the co-working space is booming everywhere in the world. And now that employees can have their own remote work, they are noticing that actually they need to be together too. So it's just a question of balance, not a question of whatever you want to do with your company. Mm-hmm. You need to find the right balance to you. And this led to another thing. Maybe you're going to talk about this, about the side hustle. Mm-hmm.
Explain what the side hustle is.
Side hustle is a project you have on the side, but not just a project to go on vacation, a project that should bring you money. It can be renting your room on Airbnb, or it can be selling things you do on Etsy or whatever. Things that bring you money. And there was a study this year from Intuit in the US that 68% of people having this kind of side hustle were working in-house, in a company, not remote worker. They were working in an office. And the number in Europe should be around between 30 and 40% of employees who have their own side hustle.
So where are humans going to spend their lives going forward? At home? In an office?
Well, as an economist, I'm very puzzled that we didn't have more remote work and earlier. I mean, if you look at a city like Paris, it is extremely congested at peak hours. People are packed in the underground. There are traffic jams. Why? Because they go to the office, not the factory, the office. And what do they do in the office? Process information, which is what their computer at home can do. And the economic gains from remote work should be very large because you can save on commercial real estate. You save on plenty of things. And in fact, there are plenty of examples, for example, of hedge funds in New York City where they do not have an office. They have their mobile phone, they go to the cafe, they trade.
But then you won't bump into Deepti and have an argument with her right. at the coffee machine.
But
I don't need that. I mean, what's the economic value of the argument? At the end of the day, I think it all depends on what kind of task you are performing. What I realized during COVID is that teaching was awful online. It's just not possible virtually. I mean, it's possible, but that's no longer teaching. It's something completely different, like writing a book and being read by somebody else. On the other hand, everything which is a meeting, bureaucratic meeting, can be done very easily remotely, and it's better, actually.
Yeah, I think I agree partially, because some conditions, or I would say some positions or responsibility needed to be in person and meet people. But I feel like they're very few, rather than all the other jobs needed interaction. Like, I'm doing a meeting with all of us around, and someone pop up in this room, and he or she got very interesting information that I could not get because I was online doing a meeting online. So having this interaction on the coffee or around a meeting or going from one floor another bring also a lot of value. And I think having the interaction in person is always a great thing rather than just being online.
Antonio Casilli?
Well, I mean, I won't go into this kind of old debate between, you know, the split between online and offline. I think that there is enough evidence that one can have meaningful relationships and meaningful interactions even online. What is true in this case is that the experiment of remote work, especially during COVID, was something that had some a hidden dimension. And the hidden dimension was the tools that we use to perform this remote work. Companies want to have control over their own information. And what happened in 2020 and 21 and 22? Basically, a lot of the information that these companies were managing transitioned on commercial platforms such as Zoom, such as YouTube, such as WhatsApp. And this is something that, in terms of PI, IP in English, so intellectual property, or in terms of patents, or in terms of managing data, is something that some companies are not allowed or do not allow themselves to do, which explains why we're back to the office. The office is the place where not only workforce can be managed in a more, streamlined way, but also information. And this explains why we're back to a situation which resembles a lot the pre-COVID.
And humans are not designed to stay at home forever. I mean, let's be honest.
This is another point. This is a point in terms of satisfaction. But one might say that staying at home is also something that allows to enjoy more free time. We're back to leisure. But if we look at the statistics of some meaningful indicators, like for instance, the leisure satisfaction in countries like the European countries, before COVID and after COVID, we're at the same situation. People are not more satisfied now of the way they perform their leisure activity. Why? Well, basically because there has not been a significant change in the way they have more time for themselves, which is the contrary of what we were promised. We were promised that staying home, we would have more meaningful leisure activities. It didn't happen. So we
who promised that?
Well, a lot of, consultants and other...
But not the boss, not CEOs, not politicians.
Some CEOs from Silicon Valley, mainly.
Right, yeah, maybe, yeah, right.
Well, that's another interesting point about how we perceive this online life that we are having, both whether it's work or leisure. At the start of 2025, the man behind ChatGPT, Sam Altman, he got a rock star welcome at a tech summit here in Paris that was also attended by the U.S. vice president. Before 2025, Benjamin Cheminade. These people were kind of like the new Hollywood stars, all these Silicon Valley bosses. Now, there seems to be pushback. And is this, they're sort of described as Bond villains even at times.
Yeah, absolutely. Because now we discovered a few months ago that even if you were a billionaire, you could be a loser.
With Elon Musk, you mean?
Bingo. How did you guess? And so, yes, they're not that, not as interesting and that they were before.
So is there a loss of trust in everything they represent, including the fact, you know, the information age? Is there a loss of trust in the fact that we're all, you know, working on these online tools for our livelihoods?
Not sure you can mix both, but for sure that if you had a look at all the money these people gave to help others with charities, Elon Musk, very well known, mm-hmm. all the money he gave to charity, or Sam Altman, and then you notice that no, they didn't give anything and they don't care about human. All the stories you have about them is very bad stories. Mm. Worse than Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was really not good, but some were good. Here, nothing inspiring. Nothing you could say, I want to be like this guy because he did this or that.
Tipti Chander, when you decided to become a software engineer,
yeah.
This was the job of the future. This was the job that everybody loved, right?
Yeah, very, very...
Is it still the case?
Well, it is. The only thing is, I agree with what you just mentioned. We need to put humans in front of those, I would say, AI tech. And when I say humans, I mean humans with inclusion vision. It's super important. We are bringing those, we talk about Musk and we talk about Sam as well. Those people need also to pay attention to the fact that you are making a tool available for billions of users, and those billions of users are containing people who looks like me, who looks like you, who looks like everyone, looks like the society representative. And I feel like it's we don't have enough leaders who are represented this, I would say, being optimists and taking care of the fact that humanity should be the central of those technologies.
How do you make humanity the center of technology? Is that because I mean, I've been reading pieces, Gilles Saint-Paul, about how some say, you know, there could be large language models that do the thinking for us.
Yes, they are very good at thinking, better than many humans, actually, and they have a perfect spelling. So, in some sense, you know, work has been conceived, say, since Max Weber, as a preparation for being replaced by AI, because we are supposed to be replaceable by each other. We are supposed to apply the procedure, apply the rules. We don't use our own judgment. We just apply the rules. And efficiency in the workplace is reached thanks to greater standardization of rules and procedures. If I'm an employee and I say, you know, I'm not going to do this because I think it's evil, even though I'm supposed to do that by my labor contract, I'm fired, right? So the whole history of work in the last century leads us to a situation where, you know, the best employee is ChatGPT, because ChatGPT does not have emotion precluding performing the procedure.
That's why I'm saying in this point, we need people who are able to bypass that vision, not say, because my employer is asking me to execute, I should execute whatever the company is asking me to do. This is not how things work. How you make sure you are able to propose your ideas and making them here at the right place, even if it's not in your team, or making sure you escalate at the right level.
But the company is not a charity. The company is owned by shareholders.
It's not about being
charity.
And
they want to make money out of it, and maybe they are wrong in their choices, but they design the procedures that apply so as to get the best possible shareholder value. So if you betray this this course of action, you are in some sense harming the shareholders. And it's legitimate that they get rid of you.
Antonio Casini.
Yeah, go on.
Now, well, I mean, I'm afraid that if we go back to the logic of workers should only follow orders, we are in a situation that can be dangerous. You know, the Nazi used to say to have this kind of defense. We do not live in that situation. This is a matter of workers' autonomy, which is not a given. It's something which is the object of a struggle that workers bring to the workplace. And now we are in a situation that basically makes this autonomy threatened by the very tools that are used for our activities, for our occupations. By this, I mean that if you look at work management tools like those provided by Microsoft or other companies, where surveillance were tools that are deployed in companies and AI tools too, they limit or they tend to limit this autonomy. And this is because, unfortunately for Gilles Saint-Paul, AI does not think. It gives the illusion of thinking. It's called artificial intelligence for a reason, because it is artificial. It provides us with the illusions of something that thinks, but it's basically just a statistical trick. You provide enough data, and with all this data, these big models are able to discern patterns, and based on these patterns, make decisions. But this is not called autonomy.
We're almost out of time. Benjamin Chaminade, how do you, as you navigate, again, this huge upheaval that we've talked about, you know, we're all figuring it out, how our workplace has changed so much just in the last 5 years. What's your personal secret to managing this work-life balance?
I don't have any secrets. I just let my employees, my collaborators, because it's very bad to use the term employee in France.
Especially because you have to provide them with an employment contract.
Absolutely. But no, that's nice. No, don't tell me. I haven't said that. But the things for now, I'm still more worried about natural stupidity than by artificial intelligence. I think it's more danger here. And there is something we didn't talk about this, but
briefly, because it's the final word.
Is a phobo. The fear of being obsolete. And this is something that I'm thinking is going to be huge.
More important than work-life balance.
Yeah. Yeah, work-life balance. Yeah, especially in France. We're in France. Come on.
Right.
I'm not sure in another country, but in France, I think we should be okay.
It's not the happy ending I was expecting, but it's certainly priming the pump for another debate. I want to thank you so much, Benjamin Chaminade. I want to thank as well Dipti Chander, Gilles Saint-Paul, Antonio Casilli. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.